Are you a mom or a mom-to-be looking for tips to make wearing your mom hat a little easier? Hoping to become as smart about motherhood as you can be? Then you've found the podcast that leaves you a little smarter than before every time you listen to one of our expert guests. I'm cognitive psychologist and child development specialist, Dr. Amy Moore. Join us on a quest to becoming a brainy mom. Hi, smart moms and dads. We are so happy you're here for another episode of the Brainy Moms podcast brought to you by LearningRx Brain Training Centers. I'm your host, Dr. Amy Moore, coming to you today from Colorado Springs, Colorado. And I am joined by my lovely co-host, Terry Miller, also coming to you from Colorado Springs, Colorado. Terry and I are really excited to welcome our guest today, Dr. Katie Davis. Dr. Davis is an associate professor at the University of Washington and director of the UW Digital Youth Lab. For nearly 20 years, she's been researching the impact of digital technologies on young people's learning, development, and well-being. She uses the insights from her research to design positive technology experiences for youth and their families, and to provide practical guidance to parents, educators, policymakers, and technology designers. She's published more than 70 academic papers and is the author of 3 books, all exploring technology's role in young people's lives, including her new book, Technology's Child, Digital Media's Role in the Ages and Stages of Growing Up. Welcome, Katie.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
Well, your work has positioned you as a true expert on the impact of digital technologies in young people. And I just want you to tell our listeners how you got interested in this field and in researching and designing positive technology experiences for young people.
Sure. Yeah. I know. I can't believe I've been doing this for almost 20 years now. It does not feel that long. But when I look back and see all the changes in technology since 2004, 2005, then it starts to make a bit more sense. But I started on this path actually as an elementary school teacher. So back in the early to mid 2000s, my first job was as a fourth grade teacher. I had always wanted to be a teacher. I love kids. I love teaching. And when I was a teacher, and this was in the early 2000s, even back then, it was becoming increasingly clear that technology was just becoming such an integral part of kids' lives, both in the classroom, in my context of teaching them, but also outside of the classroom. And I was just fascinated by the questions that this raised about, well, so how's this going to change the process of teaching and learning and just how kids develop and navigate in today's world and today's very rapidly changing world? So I just had all these questions. And so I decided to go back to graduate school. And I studied at Harvard Graduate School of Education with a fantastic professor, Howard Gardner, who's most well known for his theory of multiple intelligences. At that time, this was 2005, he was becoming very interested and somewhat concerned about young people's moral and ethical development in the context of network technology. So I started working on some research projects with him and really never looked back. You know, I've been researching this area, mostly focusing my own research on teens' development and their identity development and their relationships, all in the context of their technology use. But in the book that I just published, Technology's Child, I actually look at the full arc of child development from toddlers all the way up to college age. And part of my motivation for looking at that full arc is because I myself am a parent now. And so 6 years ago, I had my son Oliver, and I, of course, became very interested in early childhood and wanted to know, well, what's the research on early childhood? So a lot of my research is now starting to focus on younger kids in addition to teens and college age kids.
All right.
Yeah, that's a fascinating background. I was a teacher before becoming a psychologist.
Oh,
and
neat.
So very similar, you know, story as well. So talk to us a little bit about what counts as technology. Mm-hmm. And then what are the primary challenges that you see parents facing right now in terms of technology?
Yeah, I mean, that's such a good question. What is technology? You could think of technology as a tool, like a hammer could be a technology or a pair of scissors. But for the purpose of this book, what I'm really interested in is digital. So something that is digital, the ones and zeros rather than analog. Most of the technologies that I'm focused on are interactive in some respect, though not all of them. I address TV watching, which is minimal interactivity, I would say. And then a lot of them, especially when we get into the teen years, a lot of them are networked. And so when we think about social media platforms, the ability to communicate through technology. So those are the main dimensions of the technology that I'm focused on in this book.
So we're talking not only the vehicle through which we access technology, but the actual vehicle, platform as well, right? So cell phone, tablet, laptop, but then social media platforms, internet, all of that would be what I'm hearing.
All of it. Yeah. So I'm looking at the devices, the hardware, and especially, you know, how these devices are designed. So I come from, my background is as a developmental scientist, but for the last almost 11 years, I've been working at an information school surrounded by computer scientists. And so a lot of my work focuses on the actual design of these technologies and really figuring out, well, how are these technologies being designed, both the hardware and the software, the applications that run on them, and how does that interact with children's development? So yes, absolutely. The full gamut of the hardware and the software that runs on it. Importantly, the title of the book, Technology's Child, I don't mention screens because not all of the technology that I address actually has a screen. So if you think about conversational agents talking to Alexa, that's not necessarily, you open your phone and do that, but you might have another form in which you're interacting with conversational agents doesn't necessarily need to have a screen. So not all the technologies I'm focused on are screen-based.
Right, because I can just yell to, we call her Skynet because if we say her name, she starts talking randomly to us, right?
Of course.
I could just yell across the room and ask her to tell me anything, right?
Yeah.
Without an interface, a screen interface.
Yeah.
Fascinating. I would not have even thought of it that way.
I know, because we say so often, I think even as parents, like we talk about screen time.
Exactly.
That's not all the technologies. Yeah, limited to. That's
especially as we're getting, you know, the whole realm of AI is just speeding up so much now. Talking about screens is probably going to be a little bit anachronistic in a little while, I would say.
Yeah. I want to dive, just kind of switch off of our outline here and just ask something that I'm personally curious about. I've always wondered about the difference, or I've been wondering more and more about the difference in the way our brains are working and the neural connections in our brain for us, like 50 plus, I will say 40 plus age people, as compared to young people, teens, even 20 something, where these kids from the very beginning of learning, they've been having that technological aspect. So they've got that going on in their neural connections, that they're not just saying the word cat, C-A-T, spelling it, writing C-A-T, but they're typing C-A-T, and how that's different neural connections. Do you know of any research and like, what's the different ways that our brains look when we haven't experienced that as compared to all the young people today?
Yeah. Well, I'm not a neuroscientist. I, instead of brains, I look at minds and okay. How the brain is actually influencing how we think in the mind. But it's absolutely true that there's certainly research showing that as you engage with technology, you know, different parts of your brain are activated. And that makes sense. Our brains are very plastic, and depending on how we use them, they're going to change to accommodate the particular activity that we are involved in. whether or not that's creating some long-lasting evolutionary changes, it's just far too early to know that. Evolution happens in such a long time frame. And so we just don't know. There's not any research that can show that at this point. But absolutely, local changes, it just, you know, it stands to follow that whatever we do, our brains are going to adapt and be wired to accommodate those activities.
So talk to us a little bit about the difference between, you know, passive use of technology and interaction with technology in terms of development. What should we be considering as, you know, parents when we are setting boundaries and, you know, limits on technology?
Yeah. As I said, I'm covering the full arc of child development in this book. And so it's a lot of material. And it's sometimes hard to know, well, what does a toddler have to do with a 12-year-old or a 22-year-old? Is there any through line that we can say about, is there a way to approach parenting for all of these ages and stages of development? And so I offer a framework for parents and educators and really anyone with a stake in children's development to think about, is this particular technology experience a good one or not for where my child is developmentally? And it really comes down to asking yourself two questions. And the first question really addresses what you just said about, you know, active versus passive. The question is this experience self-directed? And by self-directed, I mean experiences that put the child in the driver's seat of their technology use. So, you know, when you're interacting with an app, my son Oliver has several drawing apps on his tablet, and he's very active and engaged when he's interacting with them. He's calling the shots. He's opening them up. He sees a blank canvas, and he decides what exactly he wants to draw. He is maintaining agency over that experience. And that's a really important part of a developmentally supportive technology experience, is to what degree do children maintain their agency, and are they able to, you know, maintain control over their attention, or is the technology kind of leading them from one place to the next passively? And I'm not saying that all technology experiences that are more passive are bad. Oliver certainly watches his fair of television, which can sometimes that can be quite an active experience if we engage in a conversation around it. But often it's just a time for us to cool out on the couch and not really do much. And that's absolutely fine. But if all of your technology's experiences are that passive, I argue in the book that you're missing a lot of actually pretty stimulating, developmentally supportive experiences that technologies can provide. So that is the first question to ask yourself. Is this technology experience self-directed? The second question, and this is a really important question for parents to consider, is it community supported? And by that, I mean, you know, to what extent does the child have supports around their technology experience, but also sometimes within the experience, especially when you talk about teens who are more independent and they're on social media platforms, what kind of communities are they engaging in on those platforms? Is it supportive of them or is it more toxic? For littler kids, you know, it tends to be the support that comes surrounding using an app or playing a video game. You know, the parents who are choosing how long their children can spend playing something or on their tablet, or, you know, what kinds of content is okay. That's all of that is a form of community support. And so what exactly self-directed and community supported looks like for a 3-year-old, of course, will be different from a 13-year-old or an 18-year-old. But, you know, those two questions, I think, can provide sort of a North Star for parents to help navigate and make sense of a very complicated, tricky landscape where the technologies are always changing, the research, there's always new research coming out. As a researcher myself, I find it hard to keep up with. So, but I find that asking myself those two questions as a parent has really just helped me focus on what's important for my son's development.
I think it's important too, like just as I'm listening to you, for us to consider that this is reality now for kids. Yes. And I think there's a lot of perspective of, you know, oh, you know, screen time, whatever, technology, you know, it's bad. We need to minimize it. We need to lessen it. And yet the reality is, if this is where kids and young adults and the world is going, that we learn, communicate, you know, educate, everything, interaction is now through technology. I think it's a little bit sticking our heads in the sand to say, oh no, we're not going to do that. We're just going to go play in the woods all day. Well, that's great. But then how do you function in the real world if your kids don't growing up developing those neural connections that are going to be important for them to navigate the world? Is that
right? Yeah. And it's so interesting. I started writing this book right before the pandemic. And I felt, you know, during that time and all the, you know, the years leading up to that, it tended to be in society, these questions were around, well, is technology good or bad? How much screen time? All of these types of questions that are just kind of binary and thinking about yes or no for technology. But then I think the pandemic completely changed that. And we found, oh, wait a minute, we need technology. It's absolutely essential for us to be able to keep on with any semblance of normalcy, any learning, our work, everything, socializing, it all went online. And I think the pandemic helped us as a society really start to grapple with technology in a deeper way and ask more nuanced questions about, okay, well, if technology is here to stay and we really do need it, what are better technology experiences and what are not so good technology experiences? And what sort of technology experiences or relationship to technology should I be supporting for my child and not? And so there's absolutely, I think, still important benefits to going out in the woods and playing and being off of a screen. But then there are absolutely times when, yeah, you're using technology. It's just sort of what's there. It's the tool that's around. But how are you using it? And how has this technology been designed? And unfortunately, a lot of technologies out there for adults and kids are not necessarily designed with our well-being or development in mind. And so that's a lot of what I focus on in my research is just identifying what are those designs that do support positive development and what are the designs that are just not helping us at all. And especially when it comes to teens, what's kind of undermining their well-being and mental health?
Yeah, you talk about dark patterns and design abuses.
Yes.
Talk to us about that because I know a lot of parents will set limits on their teens, you know, okay, you can have 2 hours in the evening on technology. And that's as far as it goes, right? Like, so, hey, I'm doing my job as a parent by limiting my kids' screen time. But yeah, there are things happening, algorithms, intentional design choices that are happening behind the scenes that I bet a lot of parents aren't even aware of. Talk to us about that, those dangers, things we need to know.
Yeah, no, it's so true. And in my research, when we have studied the relationship between teens' well-being and their technology use, we have found there isn't a relationship between the amount of time when you're just counting hours and minutes. There's no real relationship. What you really have to do is understand what they're doing and how they're reacting to what they're doing. And so you might actually have two teens engaging in a TikTok or Snapchat in very similar ways, but they're reacting in very different ways. And so the effect on them might be different. But all teens have to navigate these dark patterns in design. And actually all kids of starting from very small. But dark patterns and design abuses are basically features that developers program in to their platform or whatever technology they're selling to keep us engaged, to keep us on. So when it comes to, yeah, I think the the simplest idea of a dark pattern is the autoplay button or the autoplay function on Netflix or YouTube that just, you know, cues up the next TV show or video clip without us having to do anything. That's a dark pattern that is specifically designed to just keep us watching and watching and watching. And the idea of binge watching is a relatively new term that is directly related to autoplay. When it comes to social media, you know, the idea that you can infinitely scroll your feed. In the very beginning of social media, you weren't able to infinitely scroll. There was actually an end to your feed at some point. Now, there's never an end to your feed. And your feed is typically algorithmically curated to serve you up content that it knows, based on your prior behavior, that is going to keep you glued to that screen, whether or not it makes you feel good or not. And often it doesn't. You know, unfortunately, it's not the measured, balanced content that keeps us engaged, but it's the more controversial or the, you know, just the content that gets our heart rate up that keeps us glued. And so all of those things, you know, can be thought of as dark patterns. And, you know, going all the way to younger kids, dark patterns exist as well. They look different. So a child who's playing on an app and they're interacting with virtual characters and the virtual character starts crying if they leave, you know, that's a dark pattern that's specifically there to keep the child engaged. So what it looks like will be different depending on the age and the platform. But yeah, they're all there to keep us engaged and not necessarily for looking out for our well-being.
So what can a parent do? So this is all like kind of the back end, the big picture. This is what's going on. So from a real practical perspective for our listeners, okay, so say I've got kids of all ages. I've got my, you know, 18, 17, 14, 13, 10-year-old at home, and they are all trying to hold on to and access technology as much as they possibly can. That's the reality that we live in, I think, so often as parents, that we don't know what do we do now.
Absolutely.
How do I help my kids limit? How do I help them understand things? How do I walk this road without my kids hating me?
Right. I know. It's so hard. It's not something that you figure out one day and you're good. It's something that you have to renegotiate, I find, every single day. And it's exhausting. It really is. One thing I want to say right from the outset is that, you know, in my book, I address very much what can parents do. But I also say, okay, yes, it's true. Parents have a lot that they can do to support. But I actually wish, it's one of my big wishes, that all of the onus wasn't completely on parents to figure this out, because it wasn't parents who created these technologies. Well, some parents, but maybe before they became parents and realized what they had done. But, you know, it shouldn't be. We live in a very individualistic society where we place, you know, we create these societal level challenges, and then we expect the family to figure it out, or the individuals in the families. And so I really call on government and tech designers and researchers and nonprofits to step up. And a lot of them are starting to step up. So I just want to preface my response with that, recognizing that there's a tremendous amount that parents can do, but I also just wish it wasn't all on parents all the time.
We wish that too.
I know it is exhausting. Well, and I also say that because there's just so much pressure on parents today, and there's so much guilt, and it's just, and I find in both my research and just casual conversations with other parents, there's just a lot of sense of I'm getting this wrong. I'm just not doing the right thing. And part of it is because research, unfortunately, can't yet tell us the thing to do. And part of that, and I doubt it ever will, say this is the one thing you have to do. And that's because the technologies are different, the kids who interact with the technologies are different, and the context in which they're interacting are different. And so it's very, very complex. That's why I say keep in mind those two questions of, is this self-directed? Is it community supported? again, not all technology experiences are going to be equally self-directed, but this is where this community support comes in, and parents, as like a really important part of community support, come in. And depending on what stage their kids are at, sometimes for younger kids, parents are more in the role of gatekeeper and monitor of what can you have access to and for how long. Sometimes they engage alongside their children. So there's a whole body of research on joint media engagement and the benefits of parents playing alongside their children with technologies. Now, as kids get older, that's harder. You know, teens want their privacy, they want their autonomy. And this is where things get, I think, really tricky, especially if you have a teen who doesn't particularly want to open up to you. But I do think that starting with open, non-judgmental conversations is so important. And, you know, lots of parents will say, okay, well, that's all fine and well to say that, but my kid doesn't want to talk. So I do think of there might be a couple of strategies you can keep in mind and try out when you're trying to broach these conversations. Because keep in mind, what you're trying to do with the conversations is to form a connection so that you can just know what it is your child is facing. Like, what are the challenges? They're slightly different across teens. What are the particular challenges they're facing? First, you have to know that in order to be able to support them. And so one thing I would say for parents, based on my research, we found that parents and teens are a lot more similar than they let on or that they're even aware of when it comes to their own technology use. We did one study where we interviewed parents and teens separately and just got them talking about their relationship to their phones. And sometimes it was hard in the interview transcripts to tell them apart. They're facing very similar challenges. Now, the specifics might be different. For the teens, it might be complicated peer interactions. For parents, it might be complicated work dynamics, but it's all playing out through the phone and through email or text or social media platforms. So finding common ground, I think, can be very powerful. And then the second strategy is to find common ground, but then to recognize there are really important differences between me as an adult and my teen. And thinking about, in particular, what it is that teens are doing developmentally. And I actually think of what they're doing developmentally as their job. That's every bit as important as our job is to us. And so for teens, it's their developmental job to figure out their identity and their friendships and who they are in relationship to the society and their families and all of that. And often as adults, I think we're too quick to dismiss that work. And especially if it's taking place on social media and we say, oh, they're just taking selfies, you know, that's just a waste of time. But actually, you know, yes, that looks different from maybe what we did as teens, but it's the same developmental process. We were exploring our identities, and that was absolutely crucial. We did it in a different way, but still it's important. And so I think if you approach your conversations with that sort of genuine, non-judgmental, taking teens seriously, they will respond to that. Because I think a lot of teens that I talk to feel very judged about their technology use. And so if parents are ever starting a conversation with them, they shut down immediately because they just feel that their parents are judging them. So I think, yeah, those two strategies, finding common ground, but then recognizing that there are differences and that they're developmentally based.
I love everything you just said. And I think it's so important for our listeners to hear. And I think there are, you know, there's parents that are just kind of like, and whatever's going to happen. And then there's parents that are like, you know, super, super strict. And of course the, you know, the gamut in between. But I think that the thing we've got to realize as parents is that we used to make play dates. Okay. So I have older kids and younger. So my older kids, I would make a play date for my son to go hang out with a friend, to cultivate that friendship. I really wanted to help him cultivate that friendship when he was 10 and 11 and 12 years old, even 7, 8. Okay. Now what I see is my kiddos have a play date online.
Yeah.
And they coordinate themselves. You know, my daughter comes home and says, so on Saturday at 2, I'm going to meet with my friend. And she's talking about like apps and stuff. I don't even know what it is, but she's like playing Minecraft or, you know, whatever. And it's fun, creative games. It is a play date.
Yeah, absolutely.
In a sense, that's not a technology hour and a half. And I have to change my mindset. That's not a technology hour and a half. That is a play date hour and a half.
Absolutely. Yes, that's so important. And that's such a great example of how, you know, not all time with technology is the same. And so really trying to change how you view technology and what it is your child is getting out of it. Yeah, it's so important to keep that in mind.
And I think, let me just clarify. So that is considered social interaction. And so whether or not you are hanging out with friends through a digital platform or hanging out with friends in your basement, are the benefits of that social interaction similar?
They can be. They can be for sure. However, you know, ask kids, most kids will say that they still would prefer, when it comes down to it, to interact with their friends at least sometime in a face-to-face context. But absolutely, the social benefits can be very similar. They can also be a little bit more complicated because it is a different form of interaction. And sometimes you have different and sometimes reduced social cues, especially if it's through texting. But even video sometimes can flatten things out and kind of erase some of the nuance of a face-to-face conversation. And I would say to parents, don't assume that your kids know how to handle that automatically. It can be tricky for them to figure out because just think about it, they're just learning how to interact socially. And so they have to figure that out both offline and online. And it's complicated. It's really hard for them. And they do need support. Even if you didn't have to, you know, when you were growing up, you didn't have those same social dynamics in an online context. You still have to, you know what it is like, you know, social dynamics online are similar for adults. So you can at least draw on your own experience to support them. But it's really important not to just assume that because they can technically use a technology, that they actually know how to use it well when it comes to the social dynamic side of things.
Yeah. So speaking of social dynamics, have you dug in or has your research covered some of the social media bullying that we have seen and the increase in depression and anxiety that some of those interactions can cause? Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. I think that my research has certainly addressed this, and a lot of researchers in the last 10 years have been focusing on this relationship between social media and teen mental health. And I think we have gotten to a place where we can say there's a pretty strong research base that shows that there's something going on. When you look in the aggregate, there tends to be, you tend to see a small but negative relationship between teen social media use and their mental health, meaning that the more they're using social media, the lower their mental health is. But that's just looking at the aggregate of teens all lumped together. And that's not actually particularly helpful because when you dig in deeper, and a lot of my research tries to do this, looking at individual teens, you find that there's so much variation. So for a lot of teens, they're absolutely fine. Their mental health, you know, maybe there are some stresses related to their social media use, but generally speaking, their mental health is fine. There are some teens who it's really exacerbating, often amplifying existing mental health challenges. And that's really what I think the research is pointing to right now, is that social media seems to be acting as an amplifier to existing mental health challenges. It can certainly precipitate and instigate mental health challenges, but typically there's not one source of a mental health challenge. It's many, there are many reasons and there are many contextual factors. And so social media absolutely plays into that. And if you think about it, it's going back to the design and these features, it's so public, it's so persistent. It's around all the time. There are metrics that measure how popular you are and what you look like. And it just is so in your face that it can really amplify any insecurity that a teen might have, whether that's body insecurities or academic or sports. You know, all teens have different things that they're struggling with, but they can all be extremely magnified in the context of social media.
I think the thing too to remember is that with social media interaction now and the way that kids are communicating through technology, it's as if, like I put it back to, you know, when I was a kid, or us as parents to think about, it's as if we were in a social environment all day long, 24 hours a day. And we think about, like, if you think about the rise in social anxiety, I mean, I've not read the research, but I just, you know, as a parent, I think this makes sense that there's such an increase in social anxiety in our young people because they are having to deal with this 24 hours a day. And so if they're like, nope, I'm going to unplug, well, then suddenly it's FOMO, you know, they're missing out.
Yeah.
And there's all this interaction going on they weren't a part of. And so even if they try to unplug, they're not really unplugged. Social thing is happening constantly.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of concern around cyberbullying and rightfully so, but I would say that even more teens actually experience not necessarily cyberbullying, but just the ongoing stress of digital life. And there's actually the term for it is digital stress. And there's all these dimensions to it, but things like FOMO or becoming very anxious about what sort of reaction you're getting when you post something, or even just the stress of being available to your friends all the time, especially if your friends are struggling with their own mental health challenges, which so many teens are right now, especially during and after the pandemic. And all of that, as you said, there's never a downtime. Even if you unplug or your phone dies or you get it taken away, you know, it's still going on. And that itself can be a source of stress.
Yeah,
absolutely. And moms, if you haven't heard the term FOMO, that stands for fear of missing out. and that's nothing new. I can remember my best friend in high school, and I'm going to date myself here because that was in the 80s, had the most severe FOMO. And so like, no, we have to go to that party and we have to go to that party. And if we miss that party, then how are we going to know what happened on Friday? Right. And so that is nothing new. It is just now being translated into
the online. Yeah. Now we have a cute name for it, but it's always been there. And also it's always been there, but not necessarily so visible. So you might find out weeks later that you missed a party or, you know, but now you find out instantly that you missed a party because it's going on right now as you're looking and scrolling through the feed on your phone.
And sometimes it's not missing a party in person. You're missing the party that's happening online in a sense, the conversation or the responses that are happening to a post.
Good or bad.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. My 14-year-old daughter, I mean, it just breaks my heart how she deals with it. And when I'm like, no, we are going to dock your phone. It goes into the docking station, you know, and I have it gotten later and later and later, you know? So, I mean, okay, 10 PM, it's docked because for her, it is like physically painful. When I said 8 PM, no way. Her friends are still interacting. They're still making plans about the next day. 9 o'clock. It's not late enough. And that is just heartbreaking. But I've got to be aware that that is real life to her.
Very much. Absolutely. And that raises such an important point that, you know, it's not all in your hands as a parent, as much as you want it to be, but there are so many other factors that you have to consider, like what your child's friends are doing and what their parents are doing and what the school, you know, some of my friends there, they may want to resist getting their child a phone, but actually it's needed for school, you know, just to do a particular lesson. And so it's really, there's so many factors, especially when you can do so much on one particular device. And then, you know, one thing I would say about, we've been talking a lot about social media, but there's also the more private channels that what you're just saying makes me think of, you know, of the more group chat type of things on Instant Messenger or Snapchat or Instagram. And those, even though they're a little bit more private among friend groups, they can also be extremely fraught, especially I would say for younger teens where, you know, if you think about that time, there's a lot of changing of allegiances from day to day and who's in the clique and who's out. You know, in group chats, someone can be booted out of a group chat because they're not in that day. It can cause a lot of stress for teens. And so, again, it comes back to needing to maintain those lines of communication to even know that this is going on because it's not necessarily visible.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you talk about the importance of not trying to find a one size fits all approach, right? That you have to know your child. You have to know the specific technology. You have to know like the, you know, the microculture that they're functioning in, like what time are your friends going to bed? Because there's right. still 2 hours worth of talking going on, right? Like these are so important. It makes it overwhelming as a parent, right? It's
yes,
challenging.
Absolutely.
Makes it challenging to us because we have to have all these moving pieces when we try to set boundaries and limits, right? But like I've heard you say for the last 40 minutes that those nuances are critical.
Absolutely. And that is so true. You just cannot take a one size fits all approach as much as it would be so much easier. I would love it if we could take a one size fits all approach, but people are too complicated for that. And the technology is certainly too complicated. And then all the dynamics, when you think about the interaction between the technology and how it's been designed, and then the individual kids who are using it, it just becomes extremely challenging. And so that's why you need to go back to, okay, how much agency does my child have in this particular technology experience? Is there anything I can do to support them and make them feel like they're more in control? So things in social media, there are strategies that parents can help teens adopt, things like, well, you know, if there are particular accounts that you're following that just make you feel regularly like you're less than, unfollow those, you know, change, curate your feed so that you're encountering more positive content. You know, a lot, what really heartens me is to see so many peer groups now. Friends are starting to create their own norms and they're saying, you know what, we're just going to make a pact that when we're together, we're not going to take out our phones, or we're going to stop our group chat at a certain time, or some friends are turning to flip phones and we're just going to use flip phones. So that's not particularly common, but it's pretty neat to see teens themselves recognizing the stress and coming up with workarounds and strategies. But parents can absolutely help and act and take and use that opportunity to adjust their relationship to technology. So for me, my absolute weak point is having my phone by my bed at night and checking it throughout the night whenever I wake up. And so as Oliver gets older, I fully intend, maybe not just yet, but you know, we can make a pact where we both put our phones in a different room and have them charge outside of our rooms. And you know, you can work on it together.
Yeah.
Of course, then as he's getting older and he's driving, then you keep the phone by the bed.
You're like, yes, and absolutely.
You know, text me when you're on the way home. And then 2 o'clock in the morning, did he text me? Is he home? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Right. And there's some, I mean, that's not going to work for everyone, right? Like, so.
No, absolutely not.
You know, as a counselor, I keep my phone next to my bed in case I have a mental health emergency.
Of course. Yeah.
But again, that just illustrates there is not a one-size-fits-all approach.
Right.
Yeah.
So we need to take a break, let Terry read a word from our sponsor. When we come back, I want to talk to you about this idea of parents embracing a good enough principle of digital parenting.
Sure.
Are you concerned about your child's reading or spelling performance? Are you worried your child's reading curriculum isn't thorough enough? While most learning struggles aren't the results of poor curriculum or instruction, they're typically caused by having cognitive skills that need to be strengthened. Skills like auditory processing, memory, and processing speed. LearningRx one-on-one brain training programs are designed to target and strengthen the skills that we rely on for reading, spelling, writing, and learning. LearningRx can help you identify which skills may be keeping your child from performing their best. In fact, they've worked with more than 120,000 children and adults who wanted to think and perform better. They'd like to help get your child on the path to a brighter and more confident future. Give LearningRx a call at 866-BRAIN-01 or visit learningrx.com. That's learningrx.com.
Dr. Katie Davis today about technology and kids, particularly with teens. So Katie, this idea of adopting this good enough mentality for digital parenting.
Yeah, so I introduced this concept of the good enough digital parent in the book. And it actually comes from the mid-20th century, a pediatrician by the name of Donald Winnicott. He wrote a lot about the good enough mother. And so I updated it for 21st century context, including fathers and all parents in it. So the good enough parent. And then translated it to a digital context. But essentially, Winnicott's point in talking about the good enough parent was that, you know, if we're there for our children all the time, 100% of the time, to get them out of tricky situations or to give them the next activity when they're bored with the thing that they're doing right now, or just if there are tricky social dynamics and to help them navigate it all and take care of it all, we're actually doing our children a disservice because we're not allowing them the space to develop their own resilience and their own ability to regulate their behaviors and emotions, to be able to get themselves unbored if they're finding themselves being bored. So the whole idea is that good enough is actually what you're aiming for. It's great. You want to be there, of course, as much as you can, but give your children some space to try things out and to fail, and then with them adjust and as needed. And so when you translate that idea to the context of digital technologies, it's the same sort of thing. So good enough digital parents are trying their best to steer their children towards self-directed, community-supported technology experiences, recognizing that there's no one right way to do this. The research just doesn't show us any one right way to do this. So they're bound to make some mistakes, and that's absolutely okay, as long as they are engaged, involved, and curious, and ready to change course if they see that their child is maybe not doing so well with this particular experience. That's actually the best that you can possibly be doing. And failure along the way is to be expected, and it can be a source of learning for both parents and children. And then importantly, and the other piece of this is that good enough digital parents give themselves a break when it comes to their own technology use. So we are at the mercy of these devices and these platforms just as much as kids are. We are bound to make slip-ups when we find ourselves looking at our phones or checking our email when we're playing with our kids or, you know, just supposed to be doing something with the family. And we often find that we're feeling a lot of guilt when that happens. So what I'm arguing in the book is for parents to give themselves a bit of a break. And when you find yourself making those inevitable slip-ups, to try and use them and turn them into a teachable moment and where you can actually say, you know what, I have just been distracted. Let me turn my attention back to you and let's get back to where we were. If you have slightly older kids, you can actually engage them in a conversation about dark patterns and, you know, how the tech companies are working and why it is that it's not necessarily a personal failing of yours as a parent, but actually you're just like every other person when it comes to the challenges of these technologies. And it can actually open up some really great conversations. So that's what I urge parents to do, is just embrace the concept of a good enough digital parent, and really with the confidence that good enough is great. It is what you're aiming for.
Tell us about the book you're talking about. Where do our readers grab that book so they can learn about how to just be a good enough digital parent? I don't have to be perfect.
Yeah, well, hopefully the Technology's Child is available at your local bookstore. If not, of course, you can get it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble's or pretty much any online bookstore. You can get it in digital form or hardcover. You could also, you know, if you want to go to my website, katiedavisresearch.com, there's I've made it very easy for you to find your way to buying the book. And also you can sign up for my newsletter, which is a weekly newsletter that shares ideas and tips about concepts from the book.
Okay. So good. Katie, K-A-T-I-E.
That's right. Katie Davis. Yep.
Uh-oh. Amy, we've lost your audio. So
that's because I was muted. Okay.
There we go. Okay, there you are.
I didn't want everyone to hear me slurping my Starbucks that one of my kids brought while we were recording. So
that's so nice.
Yeah. So we're out of time. Need to wrap up and let Katie go. But thank you so much, Dr. Katie Davis, for joining us today, sharing your wisdom, insights from your research. I know that our listeners are going to have amazing takeaways and food for thought, right? On especially understanding that there is not one right answer, that we do need to just really think about our individual kids and their technology medium and all of that. So again, Dr. Davis's website is katiedavisresearch.com. We will put a link to how you can purchase her book. We'll put a link to her website as well as her LinkedIn and Twitter account handles all in the show notes. So thank you so much for listening today. If you liked our show, please follow us on Instagram and Facebook at The Brainy Moms. Do it right now before you forget. If you liked our show, we would love it if you would leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts so that we can reach more parents like you. If you would rather watch us, we are on YouTube. And that's all the smart stuff that we have for you today. We hope you feel a little bit brainier than you did an hour ago. Join us next time on The Brainy Moms.
See ya. Mm-hmm.